Hello and welcome to this interview, and I'm going to be having a conversation all about I, Claudius, and I'm joined by Nick Hughes, aka Rubber. How are you, sir?
Hello, everyone. Yeah, I'm absolutely great. Thanks for inviting us onto the show. Lotus Eaters, what can I say? You know,
It's good to speak to you. A couple of times we've come across each other on Twitter and realised that we both absolutely love I, Claudius.
Yes.
I, Claudius is absolutely superb. And where I did a sort of mini series of epochs in recent times, going over once again people like Tiberius and Caligula and Claudius, just couldn't help at certain points mention I, Claudius.
It is one of those shows. I mean, I did see the epochs on Claudius, and it's just one of those shows that keeps getting mentioned. You know, everybody knows somebody says, oh, you've got to watch I, Claudius. It's just one of the best TV shows ever. You know, it's this iconic series.
Mm. I think obviously it's an adaptation. We'll get into Robert Graves and all sorts of things in a moment. But obviously a fair bit of it is fictionalized, but it still gives you a great understanding. I think if anyone's out there trying to build knowledge about the first emperors or about the Julio-Claudian family, it's a great place to start. It really is a great place to start, I think.
Yeah, I think what Graves was trying to do is that he took the works of Suetonius and Tacitus on the emperors, and he was trying to fill in the blanks because Suetonius records what Claudius was like. Is it the five emperors?
The 12 Caesars.
The 12 Caesars. And he gives us this view of what Claudius is like. And also, there's all these intrigues that happen. People were dying. Claudius should not have been the emperor if everything had gone smoothly, if there was this orderly transition. But he does become emperor of Rome. The most unlikely person to do so. Mm. And Graves, I think, is really filling in the gaps. And much later, I don't know if you've seen the film The Lion in Winter.
Mm. Yeah,
definitely. Again, that's based on a real thing. Henry II's got his wife locked up in a castle, and he hates his three sons. And Lion in Winter is trying to explain, fill in the gaps, why this situation has come about. And I think that's really what Graves was trying to go for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's funny you should mention Lion in Winter, because I was going to mention that a bit later for exactly the point you've just made. And there's all sorts of examples of that where, you know, fiction actually really, really helps in trying to understand the real history. There's loads of examples of it. One that springs to mind is A Man for All Seasons.
Yes.
About, you know, Thomas Cromwell and Henry VIII. There's three things going on, I think, with I, Claudius. For me. There's the real history, which we get largely, almost entirely, in Suetonius and Tacitus, the 12 Caesars and the Annals. And then there's the Robert Graves original novels. There's two novels, isn't there? I, Claudius and Claudius the God. And they're from the 30s. Robert Graves fought in World War I and wrote those in the 30s. So it's the early 20th century. And then finally, there's the 1970s BBC production of I, Claudius. So there's sort of three levels going on: the real history, the Robert Graves novels, and then the TV thing. And I wanted to ask you about your relationship to it, because this is mine, just to let everyone know, this is mine. I had I, Claudius on VHS, the TV show, on VHS as a kid, and watched it loads of times, even though there's some fairly adult themes. I mean, there's no real swearing or not much nudity in it, but I was allowed to watch it when I was really quite young. So I had it on VHS and watched it multiple times as a child. Then, when I was doing A-levels, I read snippets of Suetonius and Tacitus, and it wasn't until my undergrad days where I actually read all of Suetonius and Tacitus. And then it wasn't until much, much, much later in my 30s, must have been in my early 30s, when I actually read the Robert Graves novels. Mm. Now, each stage along that line, I sort of had more and more revealed to me and realised where the 70s TV adaptation, where it was spot on, it was sort of exactly historically correct. And then other times when it's really Robert Graves or the TV production have made things up out of whole cloth. So, and like I say, it wasn't until in my 30s when I read the Robert Graves and really got the full picture of everything going on. So I wonder how you came to I, Claudius.
Well, I'm a bit older than most of the audience and yourself and most of the other panel. But I was a child when it came out in 1976, and I just remember at the time, you know, that it was, my parents would say, okay, upstairs, bed, and I'd go to my room, and then they sit down to watch I, Claudius, and I would hear the theme tune, you know, da, 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 da. And then a couple of times I tried to push my bedtime up a bit later, and I saw the opening titles with the snake crawling across the mosaic, and the next morning, I go, what was that show you were watching? My mum would say, oh, it's brilliant, but you're not ready for it. And she, you know, my parents were kind of a generation. They're fairly intelligent people, kind of middle-class people. But television in the 70s, and I hope we can talk about the kind of the context of when the 1976 series was made, because it's made at that time for a very good reason. You know, it's where the BBC's ambitions sort of are sky high. You know, there's no novel in history that they won't attempt to adapt, and I think that's important as well. But the thing is that these shows, much like the production team and I, Claudius, their previous effort was War and Peace, the Tolstoy adaptation, 26 episodes, I think that was, of War and Peace. And before that was the Foresight saga. So these were like heavyweight dramas that had mass appeal, that everybody who was from a working class background, a middle class background, a kind of highly educated TOF background, everybody would come get around the television in those days and watch these epic adaptations of great novels. And so that was my entry. And then in the late 80s, I got that VHS copy. And was your copy the one where it was just edited to flow in its entirety? You just put it on, it had the opening titles, and then you binge-watched all 13 episodes without edit. There were no edits. There was no, you know, each episode flowed into the other, and then you got to the end. And then I subsequently updated to the DVD box set. And it's one of those ones that keeps going. It keeps getting lent out in my house. A friend of mine will just go, oh, you've got Aunt Claudius, can I watch it? I've never seen it, heard about it. So it's all, I don't get a chance to watch it that much myself because it's always on loan. such is its prestige.
It is one of those shows that I do recommend to anyone that shows any real interest in Roman history. I saw it's one of the first things I suggest, because to ask someone to read the Annals of Tacitus is a bit of an ask. Most people these days don't really read all that much, to be perfectly honest, but they will watch things. And I, Claudius, although it is a bit dated, and although I love the acting, we'll get onto that in a minute, it's quite theatrical. And one criticism I would have of it, which is an unfair criticism, is that it's reasonably low budget. The you know, the backgrounds and things aren't certainly not high budget. But other than that, I mean, obviously the writing is superb. But yeah, I recommend it to as many people as possible. The thing I had, like I mentioned, when I was younger, it's one of the things that I sort of very much grew up with. And every few years, I've watched it loads of times. It must be more than a dozen times I've watched it all the way through. Must be easily more than that, thinking about it. And it's just one of those things that every few years, literally every year or two, I'll sort of just rewatch it again. If I'm sort of stuck for something new and it's been a year or two, I'll just watch all of I, Claudius again. There's a few things when I was a kid. Lion in Winter is one of them, actually. Again, had that on VHS, taped off the telly. And Blackadder was another one. These things absolutely fired my imagination. Blackadder, obviously, just a complete comedy. It's silly. It's farce a lot of the time. But it really, really fired my imagination as a child. I do think things like Blackadder and Man for All Seasons and I, Claudius, it's things like that, and going to certain museums and going to certain historical houses and castles and things. That's what set me up to be interested in history for my whole life. To this day, still absolutely fascinated. I wonder if they played a role like that for you.
So I call myself Airfix generation, because I'm one of the early Gen Xers. I was sort of born in the late 60s, and then the 70s and 80s, it was a lot of historical drama on the TV. You know, so you had a rainy day and all your outdoor plans were called off. You turn on and there were all these war films, or going back even further, historical dramas, a lot of sword and sandal stuff, like the 1960 Spartacus film, and Lion in Winter. And these things would get shown during the daytime, and they weren't necessarily family viewing. but they'd be shown in the daytime, and then you go and make the model kits, and then you had all those Usborne books, you know, the primer on Rome, build your own little Roman villa in the middle, you know, this cardboard model. Mm. And yeah, it's, I think there was a lot more happening in the 70s and 80s to fire children's imaginations and a love of history. And now it's kind of like, it's devolved to kind of horrible histories, you know, and not even the books of horrible histories, the TV show. And it's kind of, I don't see where the fire's being lit. Although I'd say in the last decade or so, maybe Master and Commander has fired that light in a lot of people's bellies. You know, the Master and Commander is a film that makes you want to go out and learn more about the history of it. But certainly the television was a, you know, there's so much historical stuff on television. Then you'd watch these dramas, but then you go and watch the TV historian. So yeah, I saw Ken Clark, Civilization, James Burke, Connections, all these, and then latterly Richard Holmes, War Walks, and anything Starkey does, you know. So,
do you ever see The Ascent of Man, Jacob Bronowski?
Yes.
Yeah. Again, like Guy Claudius, the Civilizations, Kenneth Clark's Civilizations, and Jacob Bronowski's The Ascent of Man. With Like Guy Claudius, I go back every couple of years at least and just rewatch all of it. It's just superb. I kind of want all of that knowledge at my fingertips at all times. I have to keep brushing up on it, you know. But yeah, I think it is interesting to look back at how. You said like the expectations were sort of sky high. Yeah, they weren't trying to dumb down anything. You know, actively, there was no element of dumbing down, which I think is great. Or to put it another way, it's terrible that things are actively dumbed down. Most people aren't stupid. If you give them a high bar, they'll rise to it.
I think that is the story. And well, let's just set the context for how I, Claudius, got made in 1976. So you're right. The bar was set high in the 70s. There wasn't this thought of highbrow. There was a bit of thought of highbrow, lowbrow, but it's interesting that a lot of, say, upper middle class people would watch on the buses for a bit of light relief. But at the same time, anybody in the UK in the 70s would watch the War and Peace adaptation or the Foresight saga or I, Claudius. There was so much crossing paths in the entertainment industry in the 70s, you know. And, yeah, again, the BBC was reigning supreme in about 1976. They pulled off War and Peace, you know. That was a big international hit. They were ruling the ratings as the legendary BBC Saturday night lineup, where you would have the final score, then Doctor Who, then The Generation Game, then Morecambe and Wise, then The Mike Yarwood Show, and then Match of the Day, right? And the BBC just owned the cultural landscape, but it was an inclusive, and I mean this in the right way, not the modern interpretation of inclusive, but genuinely inclusive. Anybody could tap into BBC ITV in those days and feel that there was programming for them and programming that stretched them as well. Everybody, when Life on Earth, David Attenborough, in 79, I think that was, and then Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Mm. Yeah, kids from, you know, I did, at that time I was doing swimming lessons. And so we had public school kids and comprehensive school kids. All of swimming pool, and we were saying, did you watch Cosmos? These shows, they stretched your mind, they fired imaginations, and they brought people together.
Mm, absolutely. You mentioned that the Airfix kit generation, I'm a little bit younger than that, but not much. I was a little kid in the 80s, basically. I had a fair few Airfix kits. I remember the days long before the internet, before mobile phones, where you had sort of a VHS collection, right, which you watched endlessly, and then you had just four or five channels, and whatever was on, that was it. And everyone would watch it. You know, you go to school the next day and pretty much everyone would have watched the same things. And we, you know, I think the Zoomers now, or the youngest generation, they just don't have that shared experience. Everyone's watching whatever they want to watch and there's not that shared experience. But yeah, everyone would watch, say, Cosmos. That was ever so slightly before my time as well. But nevertheless, I love Carl Sagan. I've watched Cosmos many, many times as well, all the way through. But yeah, the idea that everyone would watch the same thing, it's a shame really that that's a lost thing. But yeah, if we say a bit about, because they tried to, before they, the TV adaptation of I, Claudius, they tried to do it before, didn't they? And it didn't quite get off the ground.
No, that was in 1937. So
was it someone like Gielgud? Sorry, was it Gielgud or was it Olivier?
No, it was Charles Laughton.
Oh, Laughton, that's right, that's right. Sorry.
What happened? So the books get released in the early 30s. I think, was it I, Claudius, 1934, and then a year later comes Claudius the God. Yeah. So within a year, the Rank Film Organization secure the rights. You know, this is a hot... It was a best-selling book, very popular when it was released. Although one newspaper hated it. Can you guess which newspaper hated I, Claudius, the novel?
Oh, I don't know. The Mail? The Mirror?
No.
The Times?
No. What no, was it? It's The Guardian.
Oh, all right. I should have known.
The Guardian hated it. So, but it was considered a hot property. And there was a film producer in the 1930s and 40s called Alexander Korda, and he was head of Rank Studios. And he wanted British filmmaking to be on a par with Hollywood. Big epics, money, no expense. I mean, later on he does, I think, Thief of Baghdad and the Sinbad and the original color version of the Jungle Book. But in he secures the rights, and he casts Charles Laughton as Claudius, Merle Oberon as Messalina, Dame Flora Robson is Livia, and a very talented Welsh actor of the 1930s and 40s called Emlyn Williams as Caligula. And there's half an hour's footage that survives. Yeah. Essentially, Merle Oberon was in a car crash and she got injured. She was out for months. And nobody liked the director, Joseph von Sternberg. So this is the guy that launched Marlene Dietrich's career in Hollywood in the early 30s. And Britain pulls him over to the UK to make it, you know, top Hollywood director is going to do this I, Claudius. No expense spared. They built studios just outside of London in Denham, bigger than Pinewood, just to make I, Claudius. And there's all, you can see the production design, the notes, and then the car crash happens. There's arguments with Sternberg. Laughton is just not happy with the production. It gets shut down. And there's this rumour that there's a curse of I, Claudius, that it can never be filmed. And that starts up because there are abortive attempts in the years that follow, but nobody ever get the 1937 is the only one we've got to compare with. And the clips are on YouTube of that.
Yeah, I've seen a fair few of those clips. I've seen Charles Laughton talking about how he just couldn't get on with the character. He couldn't, you know, it's quite an actor-lovey type thing. Saying, I just can't find the voice. You know, he's like that about it, isn't he? And then, of
there's
course,
one bit where he goes,
because the war happens, doesn't it? And then you've got World War II, so, you know, nothing gets made then.
And then after, well, there's one clip of Laughton where he's talking to the Senate and says, you're senators of Rome. He says, oh, that's just Bermondsey. I just can't.
Yeah, that's a funny clip, actually. Yeah, it is a difficult role. I mean, I think Derek Jacobi, because Derek Jacobi plays Claudius in the 70s, he does it really quite well. I mean, one person ever said that he sort of overdoes the stuttering. I don't agree with that. I think it's done really well. I think it's a difficult part, and he does it very well, I think.
Well, I actually have a slight personal connection with the TV series, and that is my father-in-law was at the same school as Derek Jacobi. So I think it's Leighton Grammar School. It's long since gone, but Jacobi was 2 years ahead. And my father-in-law said, very bright guy, very bright guy. We all knew he would go far in whatever he wanted to do. But he did have a slight stammer at the time.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
But he did the children's, I think it was Lambda, he did the children's theatre workshop and they coached it out of him.
Right. Oh, well, that's funny that he then has to play a role. I never knew that. Yeah. That's very interesting that Derek Jacobi in real life as a young man had a stutter. How about that? That's something new. so one of the things I wanted to say, just before we get on to sort of the detail of the TV show and the actual history and stuff, would just be a little bit about Robert Graves and the books, because as I mentioned earlier, I didn't read the books till I was much older, until I was already sort of fairly intimately familiar with Suetonius and Tacitus, the real history. And so every time when I read the books, every time there's something that's just not in the history, it sort of jumped out at me. And there is a fair bit in there. But one of the things I'd say is that the TV show, the screenwriters, the people that wrote the TV show, made it a lot more linear, made it a lot more clear. The original novels, they're very sort of, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but they're very sort of early 20th century in the sense that, well, modern novels, like a Dan Brown novel or something, or a Tom Clancy novel, it's very, very, very straightforward. Everything's written in a very, pretty much a linear way, and it's very difficult to lose the thread of what's going on and who's talking now. Whereas the original Robert Graves novels aren't like that. It expects you to be sort of fairly literary almost. It's not that easy to read. It's not impossible, of course. It's not that difficult either, but it's not the easiest thing in the world to read. You have to really concentrate on who's speaking now and where the scene is. Suddenly, you know, early novels, like 19th century novels, they just change scene, but they don't tell you really that they've changed scene. You know, that sort of thing? You know, like if you read Mary Shelley or something, and it's like you have to really pay attention to what you're reading, you know?
I think with Graves, he was more renowned as a poet. And right. so sometimes novels kind of fall into a poetical structure rather than a novelistic structure. And also, what Graves does is that it's the memoirs of Claudius. And that's how he's structuring it. He's not structuring it as linear. So Claudius's voice kind of intrudes on the narrative every so often. And it's a man who is slowly dying, writing his memoirs, trying to recollect memories from before he's even born, you know, memories of a father he never knew, of the reign of good Emperor Augustus. You know, he has this idealized view of Augustus as this model emperor. And so it's structured like that, isn't it? It's kind of like it's poetical. It's a kind of memoirs of an elderly man slowly dying. And yeah, it creates this kind of dream, or often dreamlike atmosphere, because I think doesn't even the voice of the muse intrude on the narrative.
Yeah, and right at the very end, there's some sort of almost hallucinogenic semi-dream sequence and things. Yeah, you're quite right. You're quite right. So just to mention then that the sort of the structure of it, the conceit of the story is that it's written from Claudius as a very old man, where he knows he's close to the end of his life, whether he's going to be assassinated soon or just die of old age. He's certainly close to death. And he wants to write a memoir, or wants to write a history of his own family. It's a little bit of a tenuous literary technique, but the idea is that it's supposed to be hidden away for centuries until it's found in the 20th century. Right at the beginning, he goes to a Sybil.
The Flashman conceit, isn't
that's it?
It's like Graves, Graves is just the editor. He's not.
He's merely the editor of these newly found papers that have been found. And he says, there's a great line at the beginning when... Claudius says he goes to a Sybil who tells him that when he's done and no more, after 1900 years or near, Claudius shall speak clear. And he says, he's going to hide it away in a chest for 1900 years, this history he's writing, to be found obviously in the early 20th century. So it is a little bit of a conceit there, but it's nice anyway. You sort of forgive that. And then we launch into the history. One of the first things I would say, or I wanted to say about it, is that as great as it is, and as great as all sorts of different historical fiction, semi-fiction are, of course, they're going to get away from the real history. There's no way to avoid that. And one of the first things I would say is that my view of Augustus, the real sort of historical Augustus, was obviously completely coloured by Claudius, where I watched it first as a child many times before I ever read the real histories. And out of nearly everything in I Claudius, the thing that I think is probably most historically inaccurate is the depiction of Augustus, because Augustus is written and played as a kindly old granddad, like a very, very sweet, kindly granddad played by Brian Blessed. And that's not really the case for the real Augustus sort of at all. I wonder what you feel about that.
Yeah, and I think that's a thread that goes through a lot of English literature. Even Shakespeare, when he writes Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra, Octavian, as he is at the time, is presented as the sensible guy in the room, where Antony and Cleopatra are falling and Brutus and Cassius are all acting on emotion and instinct and lusts and all that. Octavian's the calm guy. Mm. He's going to be the eventual winner. So there is this depiction in English literature of Augustus as this kind of sensible, responsible. Yes, he does get his hands dirty occasionally, but it's only for the good of Rome and the empire. He's got the far-sighted vision. And I think that's the way it comes across in I, Claudius. But then I think it's Claudius probably looking at Augustus through that lens. And even if you look at the real histories, you know, when you read Suetonius, Augustus comes off as quite better, very ruthless. I mean, the prescription, once he gets power, the prescriptions that he does, bumping off Cicero, bumping off everybody that helped him get to where he was, with the exception of Agrippa. He's just so ruthless. And that doesn't get depicted. I think there's only one part where you see Augustus being ruthless. We'll talk about the only time Brian Blessed shouts in the whole series. Is there any man in Rome who hasn't slept with my daughter?
He does it very, very well. There's a few bits in it where Augustus is annoyed, and you see his sort of jovial mask sort of slip, and you see like sort of the dead eyes. Sort of this very serious dead eye sort of suddenly come over him. It's played very, very well. Brian Blessed is a superb actor, I think, when asked to do serious roles.
This is one of his greatest performances, in my opinion. And you're right. I think the way Augustus presents is as a man who's sorted out the imperial problems. He's sorted out the civil wars. He's got the empire's working nice, and he just wants a nice, easy run for the rest of his life. And, of course, things conspire to deny him of that.
Because the thing is, in I, Claudius, though, I feel, particularly the TV adaptation, it's not quite as bad in the original novels, but in the TV adaptation, it's written as though he really is a benevolent, lovely granddad who's trying to make everyone happy at all times, who's trying to be extremely bubbly and nice. Now, in the Suetonius doesn't particularly give that impression, but in Tacitus is much more ruthless in his criticisms. He says, no, he's a warlord. No, he's an evil, he's sort of almost evil. He destroyed the Republic because of his own vanity. Tacitus doesn't pull any punches whatsoever. I don't know if you've seen the HBO Rome series.
Yes.
Well, the way they depict Octavian in that, I think, is much closer. Well, it's much more what Tacitus describes. He's sort of an extremely calculating, sort of semi-psychopath. Right?
Mm.
Sort of, again, a dead-eyed, sort of uber-serious warlord. And so, again, it's difficult to come to any other conclusion that as Augustus got older, he chilled out, for want of a better expression.
Nonetheless,
I do think the Brian Blessed depiction in I, Claudius is very kind to the memory of Augustus.
One of the inspirations, the director of I, Claudius, Herbert Wise, had a conversation with Brian Blessed because they're trying to. There was a lot of pre-production done on how each actor was going to approach the part, and there was a lot of collaboration between what do you see in the character and what Herbert Wise saw in the character. And in Augustus, they cottoned onto the idea of Marlon Brando in The Godfather was an inspiration. If you see Godfather 2 shows the bloody rise of Vito Corleone to the head of the family. And in the original Godfather, it's an older guy who's got everything running smoothly just as he wants it, and he doesn't want any kind of upsets.
That's very
particularly from his offspring.
There's that bit in Godfather, I guess it's Godfather Part 1, where Michael has already taken over and Vito is essentially retired. But still sort of calling the shots, or certainly still giving Michael help, lots of help. Mm. Yeah, he's very much the Brian Blessed Augustus in that mold at that point. Yeah, I've never heard that before, but that does make perfect sense to me.
I've got all kinds of notes on how they made it and why certain actors were cast in certain roles and things like that. So, if you want any sort of background information on the production.
There's one other thing I wanted to say where historical fiction can sort of distort your view of the real thing. One of the ones in Blackadder the Third, when you see Stephen Fry as the Duke of Wellington. Mm. I don't know if you know that. You've seen that.
Yeah, and he shouts.
Yeah, he plays it extremely violent. Like, he's screaming in people's faces that he's going to tie them to a gun carriage and have them flogged to death. That coloured my... Because the real Arthur Wellesley was not like that. He wasn't like that. He was a gentleman. He was softly spoken. He might chew out senior officers sometime, but he certainly wouldn't strike people for no good reason or just start screaming in their face or threaten to have them flogged to death himself. He wasn't like that. It took until adulthood before I read about Arthur Wellesley and realised, oh, that depiction by Stephen Fry in Blackadder is just pure comedy. It's not based on reality at all.
We can have a whole other show about the writer's intentions of Blackadder. On the one hand, it's so funny that it makes you want to go and look up the real history. Mm. But on the other hand, it's full of Ben Elton's prejudices about British history.
Yeah.
And it's a double-edged production. But if anybody wants a good fictional depiction of Wellington or Wellesley, Christopher Plummer in the film Waterloo, I think he nails the part.
That's superb.
I think Hugh Fraser in Sharp does very well in the role. I think that's closer to the historical truth, those two.
Definitely.
Which is a calm gentleman who does not suffer fools, I think. And also, he knows he has to push... The real Wellington knew he had to push his men hard in Spain and beating the French, because the French are the top army in the world. Mm. And he knew there'd be casualties, but he still tried to make sure they were well-fed, well-trained, that... He would not be... This is a great thing about leadership, and I suppose we'll see this in I, Claudius as well, is that the great leaders know they have to set the example themselves. Mm. And Wellington would go through hardship because, you know, that's what his men were going through. Mm. And I think we'll see this in kind of elements of when Claudius becomes emperor and compare... So there's something that's in common between Claudius being emperor and Augustus being emperor. Mm. You know, they understand the burden, the responsibility. Mm. And again, I think Claudius has got this rose-tinted view of Augustus.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
We'll talk about that bit where he's a very old man, he's dying, he's speaking, he's in the Senate, and then all the ghosts of his ancestors come back, because I think that's a great scene.
Yeah, yeah. Having said that about Augustus, where in my opinion, they've written him to be overly nice in I, Claudius. Examples of other historical fiction where they've departed heavily from the real thing. Having said that, I think nearly all the other characters in I, Claudius are extremely accurate. I sort of can't fault it. The way Tiberius is played and written, and Caligula. I've got some slight reservations with Claudius himself, but that's the thing. But certainly Caligula and Tiberius are spot on. I sort of can't... There's nothing I ever read in Suetonius or Tacitus that really sticks out where, they've totally spun that and got that wrong in I, Claudius. It seems spot on.
Did you know Robert Graves actually turned up on set?
Oh, really?
So he was invited, I think, about three episodes in. I'll just come along, have a look at how it's going, because Graves was still alive at the time.
I was going to say, he must have been very old.
He was in his 70s, I think. He was in his 80s. Yeah, but he turned up on set, and he watched George Baker as Tiberius. And Graves loved it. He wanted to come back every week when they were recording a new episode. And he would just sit in the back, watch it, but not offer any commentary. But Herbert Wise said he had a big smile on his face during certain scenes. And afterwards, Graves said that his favourite performance is George Baker as Tiberius. He says, that's Tiberius. Mm. That's my Tiberius. That's the role. He's nailed it.
Mm. So, George Baker was in a fair few films, but in the 50s, really. Most people, out of most of the cast, he's the one a lot of people these days will probably have not seen. I actually think, and this is the most mildest criticism, I hesitate even to say it, although I'm going to, I think his acting is among the weakest, but it's still brilliant, though. I'm not saying it's not good. It is very, very, very good. But I just think almost everyone else of the big, of the main five, six, seven roles are even better. Let's put it that way. I'm not trying to cast shadow on George Baker's performance as Tiberius. It's great. But it's just, you know, the other, you know, Derek Jacobi and Sean Phillips and John Hurt and Brian Blessed and Patrick Stewart as Sir Janus.
John Rhys Davies.
They're just even better. So I don't mean that as any real criticism, actually, of George Baker. And he does it superbly, I think. The broodingness of Tiberius.
Yes, and I think that's where he comes, because everybody else has got a big moment. They've got a big scene, and he's got to internalise so much. The guy who doesn't want to be emperor, the unambitious one, the runner-up of the two brothers between him and Drusus, you know, but his mother sees something in him.
Yeah.
And so it's a tough role for Baker, but Graves thought Baker, he said he's nailed the role.
Yeah. I really, really hesitate to cast any shadow on it what I've just said. I just want to restate. I think it's great. It's just he's up against some of the greatest actors of the late 20th century there. You know, I really do think. I mean, jumping ahead slightly.
This is a cast to die for, isn't it?
I mean, John Hurt as Caligula is superb. I mean, it's truly terrifying. Dame Sean Phillips as Livia, it's, again, terrifying. Brilliant, brilliant acting.
And, well, there's stories about Hurt, because Hurt said, I don't know if I want to do this. And so they invited him to a party. They threw a party before production started. Usually you throw a production at the end of a filming, but they threw one before. And Hurt walks into the room, you know, with misgivings about taking the part, and he sees Jacobi, Blessed, George Baker, Sean Phillips, John Rhys Davies, Patrick Stewart, and says, how can I not be part of this? But he, again, he was, there's no better actor at doing insane than John Hurt. I mean, and he did stuff where he would go away. He'd only talk to Herbert Wise about how he would perform a scene. And there's one scene where Claudius, and I can't remember the name of the character, but there's two other characters, and they're kind of like the sane ones. Claudius and these other two guys are sane Roman high-ups in the Roman Empire, and they get brought into Caligula's chamber room, and they think they're going to get executed. They think they're going to get beheaded, so they're kneeling with their hands behind their back. And John Hurt didn't tell them how he was going to enter the scene. And of course, in the show, he's dressed as a dancing girl and he flings himself around. So that, aren't I lovely and magnificent? And they're all on their knees going, oh, yes, yes, yes. And he says, he spares them. And I think John Hurt was always doing things like that, you know, just keep the other actors terrified. And you do see in their faces, Jacobi's faces, and some of the other actors, they're terrified of John Hurt and what he's going to do.
Yeah, like in that scene, he's sort of painted in gold. He's meant to be some sort of nymph or something. Yeah, Caligula in the real throes of madness by that point, towards the end of his reign, where he's really sort of off the main beam. He's pretty much entirely insane by that point, lost most of the connection with reality.
I think the show depicts that because in the early episodes, before he's emperor, he's kind of like just a nasty piece of work. You know, he's securing pornography for Tiberius and sort of, you know, he's really living the low life, you know, sleeping with his sister and getting up to all sorts. And then they write in that he has a brain fever. And then that just tips him completely over the edge when he recovers from the fever.
Well, that's,
and I think they try and rationalise the insanity.
Well, that, you know, that is in the real histories where Gaius Caesar Caligula got ill. It looked like he was going to die. And in Suetonius Intestis, well, not, sorry, no, it's not Intestis actually. Suetonius tells us that when he recovered from that illness, he told everyone that in fact Gaius had died. And you're now looking at a reborn god. I am a god now. the mortal Caligula is dead. You know, even in first century AD Rome, that is sort of crazy. That is sort of fairly cut and dry case of being a bit crazy.
And you have a moment in the show that explains the transition. So he comes back, and one of the senators comes up to him and says, "You know, I prayed to the gods that I would give my life if you were, if you would be healed." And Caligula says, "So why are you still here?"
Yeah. Again, in Suetonius, there's a line, a couple of lines that give you that exact anecdote. So again, where I said there's a few bits and bobs where Robert Graves and also the screenwriters have added in little bits here and there, most of it, the vast majority of it, it's taken straight from Tacitus or Suetonius. It's quite amazing, really. One of the worst examples of where they've Robert Graves has just added in something that entirely that's not in the history about Caligula. Is there's one bit where he kills his wife and heavily suggests that he eats the baby, sort of Kronos Zeus style, that he sort of cut the baby out and like devoured it on some level. Do you remember that scene when he comes out of the door? How can you forget that? That's not in Suetonius or Tacitus. Well, there's most of Tacitus is lost for Caligula, but that's not in Suetonius at all. They've added that in. And I remember, like I say, where I saw I Claudius first before I ever read the histories. At undergrad, when I eventually read the histories, I was waiting for that. I was waiting for that bit, and it's just not there. It's just not in there. We're doing a bit of a scattergun effect. Do you want to sort of go through the episodes a bit from start to finish?
Say a few words
about sort of each episode as we go through. I think that might be a good idea rather than sort of just scattergunning it. So as you mentioned, it starts with before Claudius is supposed to be alive, and there's some sort of, well, there's tension between Agrippa and Marcellus. And that's how it sort of opens, really, isn't it? Where they're arguing over whether the Battle of Actium was a big deal or not. And the Battle of Actium is supposed to be 7 years previous.
Yes, and then it's, as we touched on before, Augustus is kind of looking long-term as to what's going to happen to the empire. So he's looking at Agrippa as his, as the successor. And it's interesting, it's not a family dynasty at this point because he's going to switch. I think he does something like adopt Agrippa as a son or a brother, just to make it more legal. But at this stage, it's who's a good candidate to take over as emperor? And he looks to Agrippa. But then we start seeing the beginnings of Livia's plot in episode one, that she has decided that to follow Augustus should be Tiberius. And it's quite vague as to why she's chosen Tiberius and not his more talented brother Drusus. And then we get a scene then with Tiberius and Drusus talking about what their roles in society should be, because they're both army officers, and this is the Roman time when you would be expected to be a general before entering politics. And so Drusus is having ideas of restoring the Republic. Tiberius, he doesn't know. He doesn't want the spotlight on him. He's kind of got this brother envy as well. And again, in terms of casting, Drusus is played by Ian Ogilvy. He's like this leading man of the 1970s. And he just gets brought in for a couple of episodes. Such was the quality of the show.
Yeah, Drusus is played very well, I think, very well. And, you know, the juxtaposed of being a very relaxed, sort of jovial, charismatic figure with the sort of brooding, dark, almost annoyingly sort of an obnoxious character, Tiberius. But yeah, there's the character of Marcellus, where, of course, Marcus Agrippa, is about the same age, or pretty much exactly the same age as Augustus. He's sort of had always been Octavian's right-hand man. Had been the leader of the armies and the navies and all that sort of thing. But he's the same age. So if Augustus is getting on in years, looking for a younger man to sort of start taking the reins, start doing some of the business of government, Agrippa is the same age as him, essentially. So he's sort of, it's clear that he's moving his attentions over to a younger man. And in this case, it's sort of Marcellus. Livia does want her son or sons to sort of inherit, and Octavian was never interested in that. And one thing to mention with the histories is that, well, what Robert Graves does in this is he goes for the angle that Livia is some sort of arch poisoner, sort of an arch conspirator who's just murdering everyone that's in the way of Tiberius. And in the histories, that's not clear. So Suetonius basically doesn't say anything along those lines at all. And in Tacitus, he does hint at, sort of heavily hint at it. There's a line or two here or there. Pardon me. There is a line or two here or there and another line or two where he heavily hints at it. But there's not whole pages in Tacitus where he's talking about it. So while, you know, using the sort of historians, reading between the lines as a historian, there's definitely an angle there. But Robert Graves definitely dials that up. And he makes Livia this sort of, well, a terrifying figure, a Machiavellian, a sort of an arch Machiavellian mass murderer, really. And again, written and played brilliantly.
Yeah, she's one of the Sean Phillips is one of the outstanding performers in the show. And I suppose what Graves was doing with it is that he's looking at the line of succession of the Julio-Claudian emperors and saying, well, there were all these other people around and they look very talented and intelligent and they all fall by the wayside and a lot of them are dying in their 20s and 30s. Mm. So what's the reason why all these very talented Roman senators, army officers, thinkers, charismatic people like Drusus, like Marcellus, like Postumus, why are they all just dropping dead?
Well, there's also Germanicus and the two sons, Lucius and Gaius. There's half a dozen easily.
And I suppose that's Graves just filling in the blanks, which I think my favourite historical fiction writers, I think it's Joseph Goldman who did Lion in Winter, George MacDonald Fraser, Patrick O'Brien, and lately Hilary Mantel with Wolf Hall. They're doing a great job at just sort of taking the pieces and saying, you know what, I'm just going to come up with something that makes narrative sense. Mm-hmm. And I suppose in historical terms, Tom Holland, when in Rubicon, kind of writes real history, but he tries to make it flow like a narrative and fills in the blanks here and there. So I think it may not be 100% historically accurate, but in terms of the narrative, it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if I had to put money on it, you know, if I really had to, I would probably say that, based on the few lines in Tacitus, that Livia did have a hand in some of these people's deaths, probably not all of them. But some of them, at least machinations going on behind the scenes. She might not have sort of personally poisoned Marcellus, like it seems to suggest, or personally poisoned Augustus right at the end of his life. But nonetheless, it seems difficult to avoid the conclusion that she was playing games within games, in order to try and, at least over the many years, to try and promote Tiberius to sort of be there, you know, to be one of the last men standing, if nothing else.
There's a great bit in these early episodes where when Livia feels that it's time for one of these up-and-coming young men to die, she sends for her doctor. And then eventually, every time she sends for the doctor, I think there's one character, she says, I'll send for my doctor. And you see this when Augustus is at the end of his life and he's feeling very ill. And she says, I'll send for my doctor. And you see the flash in Brian Blessed's eyes that, oh, no, not that doctor. Yeah. You know, because whenever that doctor's summoned, someone dies.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great bit when he decides he's just only going to eat things that he's picked personally. He doesn't trust anyone, even his own wife, Livia. And even that expedient doesn't save him, does it? There is the old story that is in the ancient sources that possibly she sort of poisoned every single fig on the trees that he was picking them from. So, but again, it's certainly not clear. Tacitus, Suetonius doesn't say anything about that at all, and Tacitus leaves it as a suggestion, really. So Marcellus is poisoned. And then we unfortunately, Drusus, Tiberius's younger brother, does die. And that does seem to be a genuine accident. Livia's certainly, almost certainly not behind that. It was an actual accident, falling off a horse, or a horse falling on him. But again, Robert Graves does a great thing where he shows that Drusus was one of the main sort of mediating forces on Tiberius, keeping him grounded, keeping him from really descending into sort of complete introspection and despair and giving himself over to the dark side, for want of a better expression. And so again, I think that is shown very well in I, Claudius, very, very well.
Yeah, and, you know, you have this, the tragedy that he only very briefly sees his sons as they're born before he dies. So again, it's Claudius's sort of memories of a father he never knew. So he builds Drusus up as this great figure.
Oh, so just to make clear for everyone out there, this Drusus is Claudius's father.
So he has he's the father of Claudius and Germanicus. And I suppose from episode two, is it episode two? Because I haven't rewatched this in the build up to this show. My last watching was a couple of years ago. So is Claudius as a child, Claudius and Germanicus as children, is that episode two?
Yeah, you would see them by episode two. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Because there's an important moment there with Claudius. Because he's bullied, he's got the hump.
That's right at the beginning of episode three, yeah. What shall we do about Claudius? That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's episode three.
And that's seen as a kind of portent.
Yeah. No, absolutely, because, of course, again, it's another classic thing. There's loads of little bits, loads of little details in I, Claudius that are just a great window into Roman society. Like, so they really did put a lot of store in bird sign, what the birds were doing, and you could read the future and all sorts of things in how birds behaved. It's completely weird and alien to us, isn't it? But there you go. Like, there's little, tiny little examples. Like, for example, at one point near the beginning, Julia complains that it's too loud at night, that there's too many wagons and people and business being done at night. And they just throw that in as a throwaway line, her just complaining about that, and it's not explained any further. But in real Roman history, they made it so that during the day, you weren't allowed to use wagons to draw wagons through the streets during the day because it'd be too congested. And well, the obvious result of that is that at nighttime, there's lots of wagons being drawn through the streets, and so it would probably be quite loud. Anyway, that's just one tiny example. In episode three, you see the small child Claudius and a bird, I can't remember if it's an actual eagle or eaglet or something, basically falls out of the sky and more or less falls in his lap. And all the adults around are sort of amazed and aghast, because to them, to the Roman mind in the first century AD, that's clear bird sign that he's been chosen. The gods, the birds, the universe has chosen him in some way, in some sort of not entirely clear way. It's picked him out.
I think one person says it means one day you will save Rome. The eagle represents Rome, and you've caught it and saved its life. So, you know, and then everybody's, particularly Livia, who just bullies Claudius throughout the whole show. She just goes, "What, old Claw, ha, 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 save Rome." And then everybody else feels obliged to pile on Claudius at that time, except for Germanicus. And even then, Herod Agrippa, who becomes an important character. And he's like the Jewish king, but he's been partly raised in Rome to learn civilization and the civilized ways. So he becomes a kind of childhood friend. And he doesn't bully Claudius. He's one of the few people that doesn't. Claudius gets wailed on a lot in the early episodes.
Germanicus and Herod, his only people that are really nice to us. Just to mention super quick, that's not the biblical Herod. It's his son or grandson.
It's his son who, after Christ's death, he proclaims himself the Messiah. And then he gets, doesn't get eat, eaten up, his skin shrivels up and he gets eaten alive by insects or something like that in the Bible. I've got to read that bit in Acts of the Apostles again. But it's that, it's not the Herod that killed the babies.
That's right. Yeah.
It's like it's his descendants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who?
Well, it's Herod Agrippa.
He's in the Bible. He kicks Jesus back to Pilate, and then Pilate kicks him back to Herod Agrippa. It's that Herod.
Yeah, yeah, and he does come to a sticky end. Yeah, it's not the one that tried to kill all the babies. Yeah, it's a generation
that's the
later.
Other Herod.
Yeah, that's the other one. Yeah, so we go on, and there's a great bit in episode 3 as well, where there's the disaster at the Teutoburg Forest. When a few Roman legions get essentially ambushed and destroyed, and Augustus, Brian Blessed, screams that he wants his eagles back. Again, a great piece of acting and a very interesting, pivotal bit of real history. Again, I think handled very, very well. You know, we can only imagine, because Suetonius and Tacitus don't give us a blow-by-blow screenplay-type description, you can only imagine that that is how it must have sort of gone down on some level, you know?
And I think it's important to mention to people who haven't seen I, Claudius, that everything is pretty much set in various imperial palaces. So we don't see any you don't get any battle scenes.
Yeah. They didn't have the budget for that, I don't think.
They didn't have the budget for that. What the sets that they do create, I think, are very good, and they're very well lit. And very cleverly, Herbert Wise goes in for a lot of... He starts wide and he gets closer and closer and closer to people's faces, and just lets the performance and the dialogue really run things. But you get the sense of scale of the Empire and what's going on in the Empire just through things that are getting relayed back to Augustus. As you said, in this scene, the massacre is relayed back to him. And it's the guy at the center wondering what on earth has gone wrong thousands of miles away.
Mm. Yeah. Although I have been a little bit rude about the budget, they still do very well with what they've got. And I do think it's directed very well. It's definitely directed very well for what they've got, you know, basically just a few sets. We've already waxed lyrical about how good the acting is, but also the direction, I think, is very well done.
Yeah.
And next thing I wanted to just mention is that you get, the deaths of little Lucius and Gaius in some quite nice scenes where Brian Blessed is playing games with them and things. And he obviously puts all his hopes and dreams into little Gaius and Lucius. They're his grandsons by Agrippa. It's weird. He married his daughter Julia off to Agrippa, who's much, much, much older, obviously. Could quite literally be her father. Anyway, they have a couple of kids, Gaius and Lucius. And yeah, Augustus, again, this is the real history, put all his hopes and dreams in these two boys. And by the time they're very, very young men or late teenager type years, they do both die, it seems, of accidents. It seems. Well, I mentioned earlier, if I think maybe Livy, if I had to put money on Livy having a hand in any of these unfortunate deaths, it may have been one or two of those. There's one of them that just drowned in a sort of a small boating accident. It seems really suspicious. My sort of senses tingle there. That seems a suspicious one, but we don't know. We just don't know.
And I think also in these early episodes, episodes 1, 2, and 3, you mentioned Julia. We should mention her because she's an important figure because her lifestyle kind of interrupts the flow of succession and history. Because she, yes, as a very young woman, she's married off to Agrippa. And then when Agrippa's off the scene and she's got the children, and she's kind of, well, what do I do? And it's her who has the loose lifestyle, isn't it?
It's a nice way of putting it.
Which results in one of the few Brian Blessed going the full Brian Blessed. Is there any man in Rome who hasn't slept with my daughter? Yeah. That great rant. That's beautifully done. He goes, he's got a line of all these senators and high-ranking Romans, have you slept with my daughter? And they just can't look him in the eye. Have you?
Yeah, the broodingness of that. So just to make it clear for anyone who doesn't know, Julia was, you said loose. It's a very kind way of saying that she slept around, basically almost prostituted herself out to apparently dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of men, even having relations in the Senate House itself, we're told, at the rostra. I mean, it's mad. It's absolutely mad. That is a great scene, though, there, when Brian Blessed sort of blows up in anger when he finds out. There's one bit there when he says to one senator, "Did you sleep with my daughter?" And he says, "Only once, Caesar." And Augusta says, like, very, very low key, says, "Oh, only once." You know, and the suggestion of sort of an just under the surface of sort of a volcanic anger. Again, Brian Blessed, superb actor. When he's asked to do a serious role, I think he's very, very good. That scene stands out, certainly.
Yeah, and also the thing is that Augustus is angry because he's the last person to find out about this. And you know, he's supposed to be the emperor, and he didn't know this was going on. Mm.
And on top of all of that, Augustus moralised highly. He brought in lots of laws that tried to make, to try and sort out the loose morals of Rome in the most general sense, to make people get married and have children and be faithful and stop adultery. He brought in lots of laws. He tried to, so to have it in his own family, his only daughter, his only child, his only biological child, to be doing that, carrying on like that. Well, he banishes her for life and never lets her come back, and she dies in exile, doesn't she? That's ultimately her story. And so just to move on then with the story, obviously the two boys, Gaius and Lucius, both come to sort of a sad, suspicious, sticky ends. There's also Postumus. Or they've got one other younger brother, Postumus Agrippa. When Augustus finally dies, we'll talk about that in a moment, Postumus also, it's the first thing that Tiberius does, isn't it? Is send a kill team to go and bump off Postumus.
Yeah, the backstory with Postumus is that he's yet another one of these very intelligent, very charming young men who are on the rise in the Roman Empire. And he's played by John Castle, who you would have seen in various things. He's one of those, oh, it's that guy. He's been in hundreds, you know, dozens, well, whatever things, but he's a perennial favorite. But he has affairs as a young man. You know, he's a bit of a Prince Hal figure. But everybody kind of likes him because he is intelligent and he does look like he could be a future emperor. And early on, nobody wants to bump him off because he's too likable. So they put him on an island in Capri or somewhere. They put him on an island. Mm. But he still causes trouble from the island. He's still a rallying point for the anti-Livia party, as you would say. He's still so, of course, obviously, he has to have the treatment. But it's one of the first violent scenes in I, Claudius. Mm. Because the violence is, in the whole show, is very restrained. You don't see much. But when they do decide somebody's going to get stabbed or beheaded or gutted, it's graphic.
One thing I would say is actually Postumus is one of the only other bits where I feel Robert Graves has departed fairly significantly from the real history. So they have it that in the TV show I, Claudius, and the novels, that Postumus sort of clocks on to Livia's machinations and sorts to try and blow the whistle. And Augustus just sort of refuses to believe it and has him exiled. That's why he's exiled. In the real histories, we don't get that. We're told that Postumus is sort of, he's not charismatic and well-loved. He's beastly. We don't really get any detail in Suetonius or anything about that. We're just told he's like, he's just a terrible, terrible, I think that's the word, or obviously translation. He's sort of beastly. And he's got a terrible character and cannot be trusted with any real power or anything like that. Augustus doesn't want him anywhere near the cockpit of power. And so Robert Graves there changes that significantly. What isn't changed, what is real, is that, as soon as Augustus dies, whether it's Livia or Tiberius, again, in the real histories, it's absolutely not clear, one or either of them send a kill team out to the island where Postumus is living out his days in exile to just kill him. Because, as you say, he's a rallying call. It's a perfect way to describe it. While he's got breath in his body, he's another claimant. So he must die. He must die immediately.
Yes, he also confesses to Claudius. He says, I think Livy has been responsible for all these deaths. Yeah. So that's how come Claudius... Claudius has his guard... From that point, Claudius has his guard up. And that, now in these episodes, we're getting Claudius as a young man played by Derek Jacobi. And did you know Derek Jacobi was actually third choice for the role?
I did not know that.
Okay, you're going to be flabbergasted as you hear the first two actors that were considered. The first actor considered was Charlton Heston. I know. So Charlton Heston, 1970, he did a version of Antony and Cleopatra. He starred as Mark Antony. And he's very good in it. And at that time, as I said, we have to link I, Claudius, the production, in with what was going on in British television at that time. So in 1972, the BBC do a TV drama of Colditz, a POW drama, and they managed to get not just David McCallum, who was doing British actor but working in Hollywood on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Man from U.N.C.L.E. had finished. He's looking for his next project. So they bring David McCallum to be the star of Colditz. But they also bring in Robert Wagner, you know, big Hollywood star, to be in Colditz. So by, you know, 3-4 years on, they go, the BBC think they can get anybody they want in the world for the role. So they think of Charlton Heston, and Heston doesn't want to do it because it's 6 months. Also, you know, he has to commit to 6 months.
And could Charlton Heston do a British accent? He surely wouldn't play Claudius with an American accent, would he?
No, he would do it. Charlton Heston never had that strong, like him and Gregory Peck never really had very broad American accents. Mm. So I think Heston in, Antony and Cleopatra just tones it down, flattens it a bit. Okay. So he would have played it that way. Okay. But Heston didn't want to give up 6 months to do the project. And then the second choice was Ronnie Barker. So
had Ronnie Barker done any serious acting? I don't know.
I think he had the whole point of that they wanted. Yeah, I certainly think as a performer, Ronnie Barker could have done serious acting because so much of Porridge is pathos and
Porridge, I suppose, and
they're looking at that side. They're looking at him. Okay. Can you do it a little bit like Norman Stanley Fletcher, but with a stammer and a? But also, the thinking was that people would warm to Ronnie Barker immediately and say, "This is our hero. This is our guy." But Barker was too busy with Porridge, and he thought he said, you know, they'll take one look at me in this prestigious production, everybody will start laughing. He said, that's not what you need. So Jacobi was the rising star of the RSC, and he'd just done the film The Odessa File as well, so that gave him a kind of screen presence. And Jacobi just worked so well on screen because he's got those big innocent blue eyes. He has this innocent, gormless look in the early episodes. And so we get back to the series. So Posthumus is now, the actors are now interacting with Jacobi as, and the early Jacobi, he's this bookish nerd, but he's not worldly wise and he's bullied. And Posthumus is again like Herod Agrippa, sees the real Claudius, sees the real, an intelligent, thoughtful person. And he takes Claudius into his confidence before he's assassinated.
Yeah, and so there's sort of Herod Agrippa, Posthumus, and his own brother Germanicus are the only people that are really nice to us. And where Posthumus sort of tells Claudius that he thinks Livia is behind everything, and then Claudius tells Germanicus, and Germanicus doesn't believe him because Germanicus by this point is they're grown young but still grown men, and he's sort of started a sort of winning wars out in Germany on the German frontiers. So if anyone is sort of higher on Livia's kill list, it's probably going to be Germanicus. And so I suppose now we need to move on to the bit where Augustus dies. and that is a superb piece of television, isn't it?
It is. And we have to get across to anybody who hasn't seen the show how compelling it is to watch a close-up of Brian Blessed's face for 5 minutes. How compelling that is.
Sorry, yeah. Go, sorry.
So Blessed's on his deathbed. Augustus on his deathbed, and so it's filmed top down on, and it's just Blessed's face fills the screen, and you can hear Sean Phillips as Livia pacing up and down in the background, talking the most inane trivia, you know. And the people who do my hair these days, they're no good, and the farming's not good, you know, and I've got to throw this party. And he's just lying there with his mouth slightly open and his eyes sort of try and follow Livia around the room. And then suddenly they settle straight at the camera. So he looks absolutely straight at the camera. His face fills the screen. Livia's still talking in the background. And I swear you can watch that, and you can spot the moment where Blessed chooses when the light goes out of his eyes, when the life goes. Mm. It's an incredible performance, because you can see a twink, just the slightest glimmer of life, and then the eyes are dead. Mm. And you can look at that scene over and over again and try and pick the exact point where Blessed chooses. And Weiss just said, you choose that moment in this scene. And Blessed said it was one of the hardest acting jobs he's ever done, doing that scene, just motionless, but he has to die. Mm. And Weiss says, and when the light goes out of your eyes, Brian, that's when the light of Rome goes out. Hmm. And that's the motivation for the scene. I can't praise Herbert Weiss enough as a director in this show, because he understands the material so well.
Now, that is an amazing piece of acting from Brian Blessed there. Amazing. It's so subtle. It's so unbelievably subtle. There's a bit Kevin Spacey in L.A. Confidential.
Yes, yes.
You know what I'm going to say, right?
L.A. Confidential. He does the same thing.
He does exactly the same thing. And it's I imagine there's a handful of actors in the world that can do that, where you basically don't move. You're hardly even moving your eyes. And yet, if you watch closely enough, you can sort of see the moment when the moment when they die. It's so subtle. It's unbelievable. It's very, very, very good.
Honestly, the life goes out of their faces.
Mm. Mm. I don't know how it's done.
I'm so glad you mentioned Kevin Spacey, because that's the such a parallel.
Yeah, yeah. And so the great Augustus is dead. The Augustan age has come to an end. And we get the reign of Tiberius. There's episode 4, Poison His Queen, where there is some suggestion that even Livia poisoned him in the end. But then we get the reign of Tiberius, and pretty soon it becomes clear that he's a sexual degenerate, mean, cruel, venal, all sorts of things. And so we see, for the first time, don't we? We see Patrick Stewart as Sejanus.
With hair,
yeah, Patrick Stewart with hair, right. And obviously, it's long before Star Trek Next Generation, isn't it? But already he's a absolutely superb actor. I mean, really superb. Steals most scenes he's in.
A couple of years before, the same production team did a drama, which is forgotten about, called, I think it's called Clash of Eagles, but it's the run-up to World War One, and it's about the prime ministers of all the countries of Europe before World War One, the monarchs, and Patrick Stewart plays Lenin.
I've not even heard of it, I don't think. It sounds great. What's it called again?
I think it's called Clash of Eagles, but if you just look up Patrick Stewart's on IMDb, and the thing he does just before I, Claudius, it's that. But it's the same script writer. And the same scriptwriter did the 72 Anthony Hopkins War and Peace. So his name's Jack Pullman. He just was top draw scriptwriter. But this is also the part of the series where the violence just ramps it right up. And it's the next two episodes, I think, are quite shocking in what it depicts.
Mm. Well, the reign of Tiberius is quite shocking. I mean, again, I must mention Robert Graves is very, very close to the real history with Tiberius. Very, very, and very, very close. It's almost spot on. Like I say, there's barely a line in the real histories where you think of I, Claudius and think, oh, well, they've got that completely wrong, or they've turned that on its head, or anything like that. It's very, very close. Certainly the later reign of Augustus isn't very violent and degenerate. and Tiberius is quite quickly. So just to mention Sejanus, he is the leader of the Praetorian Guard. And by the time Tiberius goes off in self-imposed exile on Capri, Sejanus is left to essentially run the empire. There's some sort of informer state, some sort of secret police apparatus going on, all run by Sejanus. And by default, de facto, he is the ruler of Rome, Sejanus, Patrick Stewart. Mm. And then he sort of it ultimately ends up with ideas above his station and wants to try and marry into the imperial family and wants to try and take over for himself. And so all that plays out, and in the end, Tiberius has to do something about it. But yeah, again, the shockingness and the violence does get ramped up at this point, doesn't it?
Mm. Oh, there's a horrible bit in it where once Tiberius orders the proscription on all of Sejanus and all his followers, there's a horrible bit where some Roman soldiers burst into a house and they say, "We've killed the mother. There's just the children." And they say, "Well, they have to be bumped off as well." And one of the officers says, "But the girl's a child. She's a virgin." Says, "We'll make sure she's not a virgin when she dies." Mm. And it's a horrible moment. Mm. It's just, mm. yeah.
That is a line.
It's only going to get worse in the next couple of episodes after that.
I must say, that is a line directly from Suetonius, where they say the executioners had to deflower this little girl. You know, it's as depraved and as disgusting as humans can be, really. But it's in there. It's a lion in Suetonius. And so, you know, it is handled well. You obviously don't see anything in the 70s TV show. But, I mean, Robert Graves puts it in there, and Jack Pullman, the screenwriter, leaves it in there. Because, you know, we are dealing with some of the worst, among the worst tyrants in history. You know, they're up there. Tiberius and Claudius and Caligula, anyway, certainly. So we get into sort of, we have to move on a bit, unfortunately, yeah. Nick.
I think we covered the Caligula stuff already with John Hurt.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things I did want to say, if we're just going to sort of slightly skate over it. It's just that, he goes from being, sort of, as you said, sort of a horrible piece of work to sort of out and out insanity. And I just think, I suppose we've already said it, but I just want to stress it again, that John Hurt's depiction of that is, I'm not exaggerating. I don't think I'm being guilty of hyperbole here. It's terrifying.
Mm.
It's really terrifying. I've seen very, very few other depictions of sort of someone being a psychopath than John Hurt as Caligula. It's just...
It's the unpredictability, I think, that makes the performance.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. So maybe we should skate over that a little bit and get on to when he is, Caligula is assassinated and Claudius becomes sort of, well, again, we're told in the actual histories that it's a mistake. It's a mistake that he would ever become emperor. And there's a great bit right at the end of the episode where Caligula is killed and the Praetorian Guards, or one faction of the Praetorian Guard, hail Claudius as emperor, lift him up on their shoulders and start dancing around with him as they've just hailed him as imperator. And the look on Jacobi's face of bemusement and horror even, and the episode ends on that. Again, the direction is very good. The writing and direction is superb.
Because the officer in charge of the assassination he says, "Why not Claudius? Why not? We've had all the others. Why not Claudius?" You know, it's a kind of joke. And then Claudius says, "Put me down. I don't want it. I don't want the job." And then that's, yes, you're right. The episode ends at that point.
Well, they call the episode Fool's Luck, which again is sort of perfect, isn't it? I mean, both Robert Graves and the screenwriter, Jack Pullman, they've got sort of a complete mastery, really, of the history. They know exactly what they're doing. And it's spot on. So then after that, we're getting towards the end, but then the penultimate episode is called A God in Colchester, because, of course, just very quickly to say, anyone doesn't know the history, it was under Claudius that Britannia is sort of first brought to heel, brought under the true dominion of Rome. And there's a big battle at Colchester. And so that's what that's about. But we get into the story of Messalina and and Britannicus. Yeah. So, yeah, if you wanted to say a few words about sort of the Messalina story.
So, well, again, you know, they're throwing all the big names of British acting. And so as the leader of the Britons, Caractacus, is played by Peter Bowles, because let's just have Peter Bowles in it as well.
Why not?
But Messalina, I mean, it's possibly, when I think of I, Claudius in the female parts, the three that stand out for me are Claudius's mother, played by Margaret Tysak. Sean Phillips and Messalina, played by Sheila White. And she is just, she's making a fool of Claudius. You know, she combines all the worst aspects of Julia with the worst aspects of Sejanus, actually, as well. She combines these two, you know, and it all culminates in one of the most shocking jump cuts in British television, where they go cut off her head, and the edit is right on the point of the sword hitting her neck, and it's very dramatic. Yeah,
Just say again.
You know, they've got the actual history behind Messalina.
Yeah, I was just going to say, anyone who might not know, it's a sort of a scarcely believable. She's almost a scarcely believable character in history, and I don't use this word lightly. But she's a whore, basically.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't use that word lightly. That's sort of exactly what she is. It's almost unbelievable that she actually had a competition, supposedly, according to the histories, of who can wear out the most men in a single afternoon, a competition with the most famous prostitute in Rome. And she wins. She beats the professional prostitute. She's supposed to have slept with endless numbers of people behind Claudius's back, sort of cuckolding him to the max. She couldn't have humiliated him and cuckolded him anymore. And in the end, he finds out about it, and her and most of her lovers have to be done away with.
And I think
that's the story.
The contrast with Julia is that Julia kind of sleeps with all the men in Rome, kind of out of, you know, she's a pleasure seeker and she's bored. Right. But with Messalina, she uses her lovers for political leverage against Claudius. Mm. And that's the kind of the unforgivable thing that even a mild-mannered guy like Claudius has to be pushed to sign an execution warrant, because it's gone too far. Because she's not just cuckolding him; she's cuckolding him for political gain.
It seems. I think it's always extremely dodgy ground to pass modern psychological prognosis on people from the past, especially the ancient world. But it seems like Messalina was sort of, in a true sense, some type of nymphomaniac, sort of couldn't stop herself, like just could not stop it. And on top of that, absolutely power hungry, to put it mildly. Well, she's got ambitions to sort of rule in her own right. She thinks maybe she can do away with the idiot Claudius. Of course, he's not an idiot, but that's what people thought about him in his younger years, that she could sort of best him politically. And throw on top of that this sort of crazy lust as well. Sort of really, sort of almost, really unbelievable, almost. Like, all historians look back on that and say, well, if you believe the accounts, it almost doesn't make sense. It's like, what was going on there? In fact, Tom Holland in Rubicon says, you know, everyone since the first century AD were like, what was she thinking? What could she possibly be thinking? It's mad. It really is. But yeah, the actress who plays that is very good. But it leaves Claudius wifeless. And he sort of does need a wife. Now, you mentioned a few of the great female roles in I, Claudius. I think, obviously, Dame Sean Phillips as Livia. But I think the actress who plays Agrippina the Younger, I can't remember, is it, do you know the actress who played her?
No, I was just going to say Margaret Tysak, but Margaret Tysak plays Claudius' mother.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's Frances something. I can't. I'm not going to.
Oh gosh, I should know. But she is very, very, very good. I think superb, actually, as Agrippina the Younger, because Agrippina the Younger is also Nero's mother. So in the generation after Claudius that we don't see in I, Claudius, she plays a massive, massive role in Nero's life And spoiler alert, Nero ends up having to kill her, his own mother, because she's so power hungry and so powerful in her own right. And Claudius is her own uncle. She's the sister of Caligula, and had been forced into incest with Caligula, and had been in all sorts of ways traumatized throughout her whole life, lived her life right on the edge of perhaps being assassinated and things, or had been sent to exile by Caligula and all sorts of things. And anyway, for some strange reason that, again, all historians and scholars haven't really figured out exactly why, Claudius, the old man Claudius, decides he's going to take a new wife, and he's going to take his own niece, Agrippina the Younger.
I think the way the show explains it, or that Robert Graves explains it, is that at this stage, Claudius feels he's kind of almost like an accelerationist at this point. You know, the empire must be destroyed, and an attempt to revive the Republic. But it can only happen, it can't happen by his own hand. It has to be destroyed from within, because he sees there's too many malevolent forces in the Roman Empire. So somebody does challenge in him at this point. Why are you marrying your niece? You're not like your predecessors. Why are you doing this? Mm. And he says, to bring all the poison out in the mud.
Yeah, that's the line.
It becomes his refrain.
To let all the poisons that lurk in the mud hatch out. That's the line. Yeah.
And this becomes his mantra in his dying years. And so I think that's Graves is trying to rationalize why Claudius would have done this, to try and accelerate the demise of the empire and bring in something more just.
That's a great thing to mention, I think, to call him an accelerationist in modern parlance. That is exactly what his idea, isn't it? That the Sibyl at the beginning mentions that things must get worse before they get better and all sorts of things. Because Claudius has got a son, Britannicus, but he decides he's going to marry his own niece, which is completely incestuous, even in ancient Rome, in different cultures in the ancient world, incest was more or less okay, but not in Rome, and certainly not that close of a relation. It was totally frowned upon. He had to change the law, in fact, in order to have it happen. And she's got her own son, Nero, the Nero, Ahenobarbus, who everyone knows, even as a child or as a teenager, is a complete maybe not a true psychopath, but he's not really suited for power. He's not sort of a well balanced young man or anything.
No.
And so historians have said, why would Claudius marry incestuously and forsake his own son, and essentially allow somebody like Nero to inherit? Well, it is very, very difficult to explain, but if you view him as an accelerationist, he wants Rome to descend back into sort of some sort of horror days of Tiberius or Claudius. Well, then it makes some sense, doesn't it? Now, actual histories, again, Tacitus, we've got Tacitus, they don't tell us that. They don't say that. It's left unexplained. So I think Robert Graves does a good job to take that angle.
And also, Claudius, as he is a scholar himself, he can see history repeating itself with Britannicus. His own son is yet another one of these bright young men of Rome, intelligent, charming, good moral, and he's going to fall the same way as Postumus, as Drusus, as Germanicus, as Marcellus, and Castor later on. Mm-hmm. He's just going to become another one of them. So he says to Britannicus, no, just run off, become a governor in the furthest flung province of the empire. Just keep your head down. And Britannicus says, no, I must take up my manly garb and take on Nero. And Claudius by that stage knows, his own son's doomed.
Yeah, it's a great bit that, because again, in the real histories, you think you can't help but feel sorry for Britannicus. He's basically done nothing wrong. You have to feel sorry for Britannicus. And it's done well in I, Claudius, because you do. You just feel sorry for him. There's almost nothing. He is doomed, exactly that. And again, the great line that is a Robert Graves line, it's not in the history, is to let all the poisons that lurk in the mud hatch out. And the old Claudius is sort of using that as some sort of mantra, keeps telling himself that. The last episode is called Old King Log, isn't it? Yeah, Old King Log, where Claudius says to himself, he's been as blind and as deaf as a log. to allow this sort of evil to grow up around him. And now it's all too late and he may as well lean into it. He may as well be an accelerationist now. I think that's exactly right.
And then there's a lovely scene at the end where all his dead predecessors come and he's sitting in the Senate and they're all cheering him for his reign. And he kind of just zones out of the real world. And they each have something, all his dead ancestors have something to say to him that's perfectly in character. Like Augustus comes up and says, "Well done, boy, you did it. And then Tiberius goes, "The job's not worth it. I could have told you that." And then Caligula says, "And it turns out I wasn't a god after all. Fancy that." And Livia just has to put the boot in, you know, just claw. And it's a fantastic scene.
That is superb, because there's a line in Suetonius where we're told that sometimes Livia would just send Claudius a short message, a little missive, just that's just rude and insulting, with no purpose behind it other than that. So to to take that and write it in the way it is written in to I, Claudius, is really well done. That last scene where he's actually dying, isn't it? And it's sort of almost a hallucinogenic dream type sequence. There's one bit in that when Caligula goes to say something and Tiberius pushes him out of the way and says, "Wait your turn."
Yes.
Again, it's just perfect, isn't it? It's a mastery of the actual history.
Because, you know, there's Tiberius says, no, I'm the second emperor of Rome. Thank you. And so, yes, he has to establish that authority, because earlier on, Caligula's got Tiberius wrapped around his finger. And yeah, it's a scene, and then he has the vision of the vision of the Sibyl at the end? And they say, "Well, what will become of Rome?" He says, "There'll be emperors, there'll be good, there'll be bad." You know, it's a kind of history and life go on, and things survive. You know, they adapt, they change, and that Claudius is part of this. Where I think the title of the second book is Claudius the God, because this is him kind of touching the spiritual world. We've not really had that before in the series, but that right at the end, he's tipping into the spiritual world now by hearing the voice of the Sibyl, by recalling his ancestors, because this is a religion based on making your dead ancestors gods. And it ties it nicely together. At the end, it's almost like there's Claudius trying to accelerate things, but in the end, it's not going to be like how he imagines it. The empire's going to move on. It's going to go past Nero's going to be bad, and then there's going to be chaos, and out of that chaos will come Vespasian, and then the next phase, and then you'll see that in the history of the Roman emperors. That, you know, you have the five good emperors, is it? And then, it peaks and troughs.
Yeah. You know, so it does tie it all together very well at the end, I think. Again, handled very well. I think if anyone out there is interested in this part of history, the best thing you can read is Tacitus's Annals, then Suetonius, then maybe the Robert Graves novels, and failing all of that, download or get the DVD of the 70s TV I, Claudius with Derek Jacobi.
Yeah, before they edit it, before they remake it.
Okay, time's got on. We do have to leave it there, Nick, but it's been a real pleasure to chat to you about this.
This has been amazing. Thank you so much, Bo, and the guys at Lotus Eaters. Keep supporting your cousins over at the Wellington Project. We've got some great stuff going on there, so...
Okay, yeah, no, we'll do. And so thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
If you stay on for a moment, but we'll leave it there. So to the audience out there, until next time, take care.
See you later, guys.
John, we all good? Cool. Well, Nick, thank you.
Oh, that was brilliant. I loved it.
Cool, yeah.
It's like an extended water cooler or pub conversation over something you love in pop culture and history.
Well, if you really love, cosmos, civilization, the ascent of man. We could have another conversation about one of those if you want. I mean, civilization. I'd love to have a conversation about Ken Clark's civilization.
I think we could expand that into what the, you know how the BBC are kind of living in its own ashes at the moment.
But
there was that time in the 70s when practically, so much of what they did in the 70s is the standard. And to look at Cosmos, Connections, The Ascent of Man, Civilization.
Yeah, great.
Although I think Civilization was actually ITV. But
it was BBC Two, I believe. It was BBC Two, yeah.
But we can look at what made these landmark shows what they were. What did they do right that's not being done right now?
Yeah.
What was the audience response? Why do these shows have cultural cachet? And why have they all ended up on the Prevents warning list,
yeah,
as it were? And because I think 70s British TV is kind of, is a high watermark,
mm-hmm,
where I think that it was truly a centrist, you know, impartial organization. Mm. And they just said, who's the best guy for this job? Who's the best guy who knows about this?
Mm.
Hire him.
Mm.
Get him to make this show.
Mm.
And you know, who's one of our guys on our side of the political aisle. They genuinely went and found the best people. And I think there could be a really good conversation in that era of the BBC knocking it out of the park, mm, in terms of history, science, drama.
Yeah, a good place.
I think the show, it's called Gathering of Eagles.
Ah, oh, okay. It sounds great. I mean, I'd love to find that and watch that. It sounds great. Yeah, I think maybe a good place to start. It's a great angle to, as I say, sort of juxtapose it to modern day BBC productions. Kenneth Clark's Civilization was the first one. It was very, I think it came out in like 1969. So it's one of the first things that BBC Two did in colour. Unbelievably.
Yes.
They just picked the best guy. They just picked Kenneth Clark, one of the greatest art historians in the world. They didn't care about his politics. He was just the best. So they used him. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It's like later, you know, who can communicate science brilliantly? Carl Sagan. and then yeah. I think the last days of when the BBC, you know, who's the best Tudor expert in the world? David Starkey. Who's the best battlefield historian? Richard Holmes. They just got, you know, the top people.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think it'd be good to look at that kind of era.
Mm.
And juxtapose it with where it's gone wrong,
mm,
in recent years.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, Nick, well, I'll let you go. I hope you have a good day.
I've got to get back to work now, my day activities and everything. But Bo, thanks so much for inviting us on.
Yeah, no worries. It won't go out for, I would have thought, a week, maybe even 2 weeks before it goes out. But I'll send you the links. I'll let you know when we know exactly. And
yeah,
I'll send you links on Twitter and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I can sort of spread the word. Keep up the good work, the whole team and everything.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay. Cheers. I'll be off now.
All right.
Thanks.
Cheers. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.